Excuse me, gentlemen. I see you're listening to Underwood and Flinch.
It's a podcast, isn't it, man?
Perhaps you'd be kind enough to tell our listeners. How would you describe Underwood and Flinch?
Well, it's like a vampire story.
No, man. It's not a vampire story. It's so much more than that. It's like a scene, man.
No, it's more than a scene. It's like a lot of scenes. Like a whole movie.
Well, yeah, I suppose.
Thank you so much. And now, Mike Bennett Podcast Studios presents Underwood and Flinch Underground. It's a scene, man. Hello, patrons, and welcome back to Underwood and Flinch Underground. And yes, it is a scene, And we are all the happy participants, if that's what you call people who participate in a scene. We don't have special beards or hair or special types of clothing. All we have is a pair of earbuds and the contents being piped therein. And so, in complete secrecy, we are, secretly, mind you, the hippest cats on the planet. We, the privileged few, the groovy underground, that one day other people will pretend that they were part of years ago. But they weren't. Only we are. Only we. Aren't we?
Oh, totally.
Oh, good. Right, well, now that's established, let's move on. So, here we are, in Underwood and Flinch Underground, episode 42. I posted the story bit yesterday night at about 11:30 p.m, having worked on it all day, till my fingers bled and my feet were blistered from all the audio editing. I don't know why, maybe I'm doing it wrong. But anyway, I got it online before the end of the month. So, huzzah!
Huzzah!
Thank you. But sadly, it was without the bumpers. That is, this bit that you're listening to now, and the other bit that comes at the end. The reason for this was that if I had written them last night and recorded them, I wouldn't have made my deadline. And I had to do that, even if it meant going bumperless. But now, having slept and what have you, I've done these bumpers and have reposted the episode, and that's basically what you're listening to now. And having said that, let's get to the story catch-up bit. This episode continues what I call in my head the Lydia and Black Circle novel within the novel, sort of. By which I mean the ongoing backstory adventures of Lydia and her friends that was going on in the background to all the other events of Underwood and Flinch Underground, but until this section of the story that we're listening to at the moment, we've only had glimpses of. Now, you'll recall that last time we had a lot of historical information about Gerald and Cynthia, and we saw how Gerald met Alice, since he's, you know, basically her de facto jailer, sort of, and so inevitably has that kind of contact with her. You know, bringing her food, walking the dog, Charlie. You remember the dog, Charlie. And so that's where we're picking things up this time. As we begin episode 42, the Bensons have had a busy day and have gone to bed, and all is well, until something causes Cynthia to wake up. You know how that happens sometimes? A noise, a sound wakes you, but you don't know what it is that's woken you because you didn't consciously hear it. You don't even know that something woke you up at all. It's like you just kind of came to without understanding. Underwood and Flinch, Underground. A novel written and performed for podcast by Mike Bennett. This podcast is intended for an adult audience. Episode 42. Cynthia's eyes opened to darkness. It was a sudden and unexpected contrast to her dream, which was all bright sunlight. She and Peter Harris, still young, in a rowing boat on the Thames at Henley. Peter had been telling her how awful it was having to drink blood, and she'd been admiring his naked chest, which was far more ripped than she remembered it ever having been in reality. He'd been a slender lad, but in the dream he'd had a torso like a model from Men's Health magazine, muscular and shaven smooth as a baby's bum. And then it had all vanished, quite suddenly, to be replaced by the heavily curtained darkness of this unfamiliar bedroom. Annoyed, Cynthia turned in the bed, expecting to find Gerald in between loud snores, which was what normally interrupted her sleep, especially when, like today, he'd been drinking. But he lay on his side, turned away from her, his body rising and falling with silent breaths, and not so much as a snuffle. How odd, she thought as she got up to go to the bathroom. She had also had a few drinks that afternoon, and so had drunk lots of water to ensure she didn't get a hangover, something she was no longer able to shrug off as she had as a younger woman. Anything more than 3 glasses of white wine, and she'd be wiped out with a migraine for the following 24 hours. It was Gerald's fault, of course. After he'd done the shopping and walked Charlie the dog, they'd had breakfast before setting off to visit the list of Underwood's homes Lydia had given them. Fortunately, most of the properties had been built within a short distance of underground stations, so getting around to see them all hadn't been too problematic. All of them had been quiet, immaculately maintained houses, and none of them displayed any signs of life within. She and Gerald had wandered slowly past each of them, trying to look as if they were searching for a particular door number. They would go on a few houses past the house in question, then stop and saunter back for a second perusal, before acting as though they'd given up on finding their elusive address and moving on. They'd managed to get round all the houses by lunchtime, and then had lunch in one of Gerald's old haunts from his work days, Ye Old Cheshire Cheese in Fleet Street. The pub had been packed, but Gerald had spotted a couple of his old colleagues and they'd been able to join them at their table. After lunch, unwilling to be part of another round of drinks and thoroughly bored by the men's talk of contracts, clients and absent colleagues, Cynthia had left Gerald with his friends to do some shopping. He said he'd give her a ring when he left, which he didn't, because he'd stayed in the pub all afternoon. When she returned at 5 o'clock, he was red-faced and in garrulous flow with an entirely different set of men in suits, all from the same company, who had replaced the earlier shift. She joined them for another glass of white wine, and Gerald's telling them drunkenly what a wonderful woman she was, before she was finally able to drag him away and into a taxi. They got home soon after Lydia and Miguel's awakening. Lydia had been getting ready to go out on her date with James Harrington, the man whom she thought could be connected to another vampire, so she was in high spirits, unlike Miguel, who'd been thoroughly morose about having to take the night shift on the same reconnaissance tour of Underwood's homes as the Bensons had done that morning.
"Why do I need to do this?"
Miguel whined as he flung himself down onto the sofa. He was wearing nothing but the boxer shorts he'd slept in and still had some of Alice's dried blood on his face.
"Gerald and Cynthia have already done it, and they say there's nothing to see." "Just accept it, Lydia. Underwood is dead. Let's celebrate and move on."
"We don't know that for sure, Miguel," said Lydia. "If his stuff is coming from Spain, we have to be sure that he isn't alive and coming with it. And if he is, he's far more likely to be arriving at night than in broad daylight, wouldn't you say?"
"But I don't want to do it. I'm a vampire. I want to go out hunting for a new chica to replace this homeless one and her fucking dog."
"You're going to do that, are you?"
Gerald slurred over a cup of strong black coffee.
"Replace her?"
"Si, she is all used up."
"What?"
said Gerald, suddenly angry.
"What do you bloody mean, she's used up?"
"He means she's given us enough blood, and so now needs to be released," said Lydia.
"But she's definitely going to do that, yeah?"
"Of course. We can't just be feeding off the same victim night after night, or she'll die." Miguel scoffed. So what if she dies? No one will miss her, except her fucking dog. We don't know that, Miguel, said Lydia without looking up from where she sat painting her nails at the dining table. Even homeless people have friends and families. Someone will miss her eventually.
But by then we will be long gone, said Miguel with a grin.
That's not the bloody point, is it? Gerald slurred. There's no reason to kill her. She's done nothing wrong. She's just a poor girl who had the bad luck to run into you two.
Gerald! Cynthia gasped, looking from him to Lydia with a look of embarrassed astonishment.
What?
Said Gerald.
It's true, isn't it?
Lydia, he's drunk. He doesn't know what he's saying. It's all right, darling, said Lydia. Gerald's right, which is precisely why we're going to let her go.
When?
Said Gerald. Well, we can't put her out on the streets tonight, can we? That would be cruel. Especially considering her weakened condition. No, we'll do it tomorrow, morning or afternoon, as soon as she feels strong enough. So you won't be discharging her yourself? Asked Cynthia. No, I think it's best she go during the day, don't you? But you'll prepare her. I mean, you'll make it so that she doesn't remember us or want to stay, even. I don't want to have to push her out. Of course I will. You've nothing to worry about, darling. She'll toddle off quite happily, and all memory of us will be gone before she reaches the end of the road. And so Cynthia had explained their tube route around Underwood's houses to Miguel, and Lydia had gone upstairs to get dressed for her date. Then, later, they had left together in a taxi, and Cynthia and Gerald had sat down to watch television. Gerald had fallen asleep 5 minutes into Inspector Morse and started snoring, so Cynthia sent him up to bed. She followed him up later when the show was over, and she'd let Charlie out in the back garden to do his business. A loud thud suddenly resonated through the ceiling above, bringing Cynthia back to the ensuite bathroom. It was followed by a muted cry.
Puta de madre!
Cynthia looked up from where she sat on the toilet. Wasn't that Alice's room above theirs? Maybe it was Miguel's. Another thump, and another.
Puta!
Gerald, did you hear that? Gerald didn't reply. Obviously, he was still in a beer coma. Cynthia hastily washed her hands and hurried back into the bedroom. She turned on the light. Still, Gerald didn't stir. She considered shaking him awake, but decided not to bother. If Miguel had fallen and hurt himself, Gerald wasn't going to be any use in his present condition. She went out into the hall, switched on the light, and went upstairs. At the landing of the next floor, she was surprised to see Charlie lying with his chin on his paws. He didn't rise on seeing her, just watched as she came over and knelt beside him. "Hello, Charlie. What are you doing out here?" His tail beat gently on the carpet as she petted his head, and he leaned in to her touch, whimpering softly. Gerald had said that the dog slept with Alice, but evidently this wasn't the case. "Good boy," she said, giving him a final pat before continuing on down the hall to the room above theirs. There was no light shining under the door, but she reminded herself that there wouldn't be. Miguel could see in the dark. Though not so well as he couldn't avoid falling arse over tit in his bathroom, she thought. She was about to knock at the door when she heard the sound of sobbing from within. She paused, listening. It was definitely him. The sobbing was punctuated with muttered Spanish. For the briefest of moments, she considered going away and minding her own business. Maybe he was having a moment of regret, of remorse for what he had become, for the pain he had brought to Monica, to Alice, and would have to bring to 1,000 others as yet unknown. Then she reminded herself it was Miguel. She knocked.
Miguel, are you okay?
A pause, then...
Who is... Cynthia?
Yes, dear. I heard a crash. I thought you might have fallen. A second later, the door opened, enough for him to look out. She hadn't turned on the light on this floor and had only the dim light that filtered up the stairway from below to see by. His naked body appeared to be glistening, wet with a dark liquid. Then, The smell drifted out from the stuffy room, cloying and coppery.
"I've had an accident," said Miguel.
"Are you hurt?"
It's not me. I...
He hesitated, then turned on the light. He was covered in blood. Then he swung the door fully open to reveal the empty, blood-soaked bed.
"It's Alice."
Cynthia's hand went to her mouth.
"Oh, shit. What happened?"
"It's not my fault," he blurted out. "I found someone to replace her, but she got away. So when I came home, I was hungry. I was only going to take a little, but it went wrong. I don't know what happened."
The bloodstain completely blotted the top half of the bed, soaking the sheet and pillows. It recalled to Cynthia's mind incarnadine memories of the Black Circle sacrifices back in Spain. It was that bad, as if Alice had been strung up over the bed and had had a throat cut from ear to ear.
"Where is she?"
asked Cynthia.
"In the bathroom. I was gonna wash her, like we did with Monica, but the body was dripping everywhere and my feet slipped on the tiles and I was putting her in the shower when you came."
From behind Cynthia, Charlie started barking. She turned. He was keeping well back from the door, looking between her ankles into the room and trembling.
"Cierra la puta boca!" Miguel shouted. "Vete, perro! I fucking kill you!"
Charlie immediately fell silent and slunk away.
"I told him before. He growled at me when I came in, you know, like he's some kind of fucking German shepherd. But I look him in the eye and say to him, 'Shut up.' And straight away, he is quiet. It's like we have the power over the dogs, like we do over people, huh? I sent him outside so I could..."
His face contorted with anxiety and he put a hand in his hair.
"Shit, man. Lily's going to kill me."
Cynthia reached out, intending to put a comforting arm around him, but the still wet blood on his body stayed her. She didn't want to ruin her nightie. Instead, she gave him a reassuring pat on the shoulder.
"There, there. I'm sure she'll understand."
"No, she won't. She told me, warned me to be careful, and I fucked up again."
"What's all this barking and commotion up here?"
came Gerald's voice from down the hall.
"What are you doing in Alice's room?"
"Oh, Christ," said Cynthia.
She turned just as Gerald arrived at her back.
Darling, there's been an accident."
"Accident? What kind of accident? Is she all right?"
"No, dear."
"Oh, he hasn't."
Gerald pushed past her into the room and saw the bed. He gasped and turned to Miguel.
"What have you done, you bloody animal?"
Miguel raised a warning finger to Gerald's face.
"Don't shout at me, old man, or I'll show you just how much of an animal I can be."
"Where is she? What have you done to her?"
"I had a fucking accident. I was feeding and I fell asleep."
"You fell asleep? How did you manage to fall asleep with your bloody teeth in her neck?"
"There wasn't in her neck at the time. I was..."
His pointing finger closed into a fist.
"You don't understand, Gerald. Sometimes, la intimidad, the intimacy, your mouth on the woman's neck and the blood, it is like a sexual thing."
Gerald's face darkened.
"You mean you were?"
"As she wanted it. It wasn't like rape or..."
Gerald punched Miguel in the face before he could finish. Miguel swore and staggered back, his hands going to his nose where blood began to pour through his fingers.
"Ah, my nose! Hijo de puta, you broke my fucking nose!"
Cynthia caught Gerald's shoulders.
"For God's sake, Gerald, this isn't helping anything."
"It's helping me!"
Gerald raised his fists.
"Come on, defend yourself, Miguel, and we'll have none of that fascination nonsense either."
"Gerald!"
cried Cynthia.
"He'll kill you! Have you forgotten what he is now?"
"Forgotten? How can I forget? Look at the bed! Look at what he's done! First Monica, now Alice! Oh, he doesn't need to worry about Lydia killing him. I am going to do it for her."
He stepped smartly forward and struck again, a left jab smacking into the hands covering Miguel's face.
"Come on, damn you!"
Gerald jabbed with his right, but this time Miguel's hand spun around and caught his fist.
Hit me again, Gerald, and I'll put you to the fucking wall.
Miguel tightened his grip on Gerald's fist, just a little, knowing that if he didn't restrain himself, he would crush the delicate bones like dry sticks. Gerald gasped, then his mouth gaped in a silent scream. He grabbed Miguel's wrist, trying to break his hold on him, but the arm that held him was like steel.
"Miguel, let him go," cried Cynthia. "He's been drinking. He's not himself. You know that. Please, for the love of Satan, let him go."
Miguel smiled, his bloody lips drawing back over his now sharp teeth, as gently he began to ease his hand downwards. He chuckled as Gerald's knees gave way beneath him.
"Say sorry, old man."
Gerald's defiant rebuke died on his lips as he felt Miguel's grip tighten. He screamed,
"Oh, sorry! I'm sorry!"
Miguel opened his hand like a magician ending a successful conjuring trick.
"That's better. But I warn you, Gerald, don't ever do anything like that again. Or next time, I will crush your hand like a paper fucking cup."
Gerald nursed his hand and kept his peace. He had lost his temper and made a very foolish mistake. He was lucky Miguel hadn't done far worse than he had, and he knew it. But he couldn't let him have the last word.
"You shouldn't have hurt her. You know you shouldn't." "Of course I know. You think I wanted her to die? It was a fucking accident, I keep telling you."
"Miguel, please," said Cynthia. "Calm down, both of you. Just calm down. We need to get things into some kind of order before Lydia gets back."
"Is she not back yet?"
said Gerald, before adding,
No, of course she isn't. She'd have to be as deaf as a post if she were. What time is it?"
They all looked at the clock by Alice's bed.
"Christ, it's almost 3 in the morning. What are we going to do with the body? We can't dispose of it now. It's too late. We'll have to wait till tomorrow night."
"No," said Miguel. "If Lydia comes back and finds this, Jesus Christ, she's going to be so fucking angry. I at least have to get rid of the body. Don't worry, I will deal with it."
"God knows you have experience," muttered Gerald.
Miguel was about to respond when Cynthia quickly intervened.
"I'll help you, Miguel. You said you've already got the body in the shower?"
"Si."
"Well, that's a start."
She looked at Gerald.
"You should go back to bed, Jerry. Try and get some sleep."
"Sleep?"
said Gerald.
"How the hell do you think I'll sleep knowing you two are up here getting a corpse ready for disposal?"
"Jesus Christ, it sounds insane when I hear myself say it. We're seriously planning on getting rid of a dead body in London? Christ, we can't! There are no handy arroyos round here. We'll have to dismember her, take her away in pieces."
"No, this takes too long," said Miguel. "We need her out of here in 1 hour. I can't do it. I don't need your help."
"Yes, you do," said Cynthia. "We have to make sure the body is cleansed of your DNA, whatever weirdness that looks like. The police may never have seen vampire DNA before, but there are no guarantees that your genetic code isn't still in the soup somewhere."
"Did you come in her?"
Gerald asked Miguel.
"What? When you were raping her, did you come in her? You know, ejaculato?
It was not rape. No, I did not come in her. I mean, I don't remember. Maybe."
"Which means you did."
"Which means I can't fucking deal with it, okay?"
"Oh, just shut up, Miguel," said Cynthia. "Please, just leave this to us. You go downstairs and fetch us some bin bags, bleach and rubber gloves. We'll do the rest."
"Including the cutting?"
said Miguel.
"What cutting?"
"We have to cut her."
He pointed to his neck.
"Take out the bite wound. Make it look like a..."
He stopped and frowned.
"I don't know the word. How do you say..."
Then he mimed, knifing someone.
"A stabbing,"
said Gerald grimly.
"See, make you look like a stabbing."
"I'm not doing that,"
said Gerald.
"And nor are you, Miguel. You've done more than enough damage for one night."
"Well, then I'll have to do it, won't I?"
Cynthia snapped. Now, can we please stop arguing and get on with it? We're wasting time. And so they did. Cynthia washed Alice's body under the shower, and her years of domestic culinary experience served her well when it came to carving the bite wound cleanly from the neck. But Gerald said it was too clean for a crime of violence. It needed to be more brutal. That was when Cynthia's stoicism had buckled. She couldn't do it. So Gerald, by then stone-cold sober, took the knife and hacked at the wound and stabbed Alice's torso repeatedly until, with tears in his eyes, he dropped the knife, fell back from the shower, and covered his face with his hands. He wanted to scream, to curse, to say the things he felt in his heart to his wife, who was now washing the body down again with a bleached sponge in the hope that their and Miguel's DNA would be washed away. But he couldn't. Miguel, now dressed, was in the bedroom, taping black refuse sacks together to make a large black sheet, and complaining he couldn't use the roll of sticky tape effectively with his marigold-clad hands. And when Cynthia had washed the bleach away, having cleansed the body as thoroughly as she could, Miguel brought his creation in, and he and Gerald rolled the dripping body out and onto its black plastic shroud. Then they wrapped her in it, concealing the cold white flesh completely, and taped it closed. It was done. They looked at the clock. It was now just after 4 a.m.
Oh, it's too late, said Gerald. Let's just leave her here. No one's going to be using this room again.
No, said Miguel. She has to go before Lydia comes home. Just leave it to me. I do it.
Miguel, you can't just dump her by the side of the road, said Gerald. She absolutely cannot be found. It's too risky. There's CCTV everywhere in London. No, the best thing to do is to leave her here, and tomorrow night we'll drive her out of London and bury her in a wood or something.
Miguel shook his head.
No, Lydia's going to want this room for the next victim. We need it. I don't want to piss her off any more than this is going to piss her off already.
He hauled the body up onto his shoulder.
I have to do it now. I find somewhere good, somewhere quiet.
Damn it, Miguel!
Miguel grabbed Gerald by the face, squeezing his cheeks and pushing out his lips in a grotesque pout.
You forget already, Gerald, you are not the boss here. I say she goes, and so I take her. And you two, stay here. Go to bed. I'll be back before the sun rises, and it is like the whole thing never happened.
He looked back into the bedroom at the crimson mattress and bloody footprints all over the once white carpet.
Almost.
Cynthia went to Miguel's side and rested a hand on the arm that held Gerald in a face clench. In a gentle, appeasing tone, she said, All right, Miguel, you're the boss. We're only trying to help. You know that.
Oh, yeah, you are trying to help me, and I thank you for this. But he wants to treat me like a little bitch.
Gerald tried to protest, but his words came out as,
He's just a bit upset, Miguel, said Cynthia.
I'm no little bitch. I am his fucking master.
He lifted Gerald onto his tiptoes.
Maybe you should call me that, no?
Gerald gasped. Calmly, Cynthia said,
I think Lydia is the master here, don't you?
Lydia is not here.
But she will be soon. So, if you're going to get rid of that body, there's no time to lose.
Miguel released Gerald.
So stop wasting my time. I go.
Then, with the body slung over his shoulder, he strode from the room, leaving a trail of pink and crimson water droplets in his wake. Cynthia went to Gerald, who was sitting on the toilet seat and massaging his face.
Are you all right, Gerald?
Eyes downcast, Gerald replied quietly.
Yes.
I'm sorry, darling, but at least it's over now.
It's not over, Sin. It's only just beginning.
From downstairs, Miguel roared,
What are the fucking car keys?
He's going to fuck this up, said Gerald.
He might not.
Gerald got up.
If he doesn't, it'll be a first. What are the car keys?
Miguel shouted up the stairs.
Gerald stormed to the stairs and shouted down.
In the kitchen! On the work surface under the cookbooks!
Cynthia came to his side and they waited until they heard the front door slam. Then Gerald said,
I bet he drives on the wrong side of the road.
Probably.
And police will pull him over. He's not insured.
Cynthia laughed and put her arm around him.
What?
Said Gerald. You think that's going to matter? His lack of insurance? Saying it aloud made her laugh again, though more from a sense of relief than humour. Then Gerald, realising the absurdity of what he had said, laughed too.
It's all right for you. It's my bloody name on the documents.
He returned her embrace and they held each other.
I'm sorry, darling, said Gerald. I shouldn't have lost my rag with him.
It's not your fault, Jerry. You're only human.
Yes, yes, I am. Human.
He eased her from him so their eyes could meet.
Things are only going to get worse, Sin. You know that?
Oh, please, Jerry, not now. Let's just go to bed.
He wants us to call him Master.
Oh, he was just angry. You both were. He'll be his normal self tomorrow, once Lydia's kicked his ass back into line.
You think so?
Yes. And once we become vampires, there won't be any more of this nonsense, I can tell you. Gerald released her and turned away, sighing.
Oh, really? That's still what you want?
Jerry, I know it's difficult right now, but this will pass. You can see that there's a discipline to it, can't you? A way of existing without killing. Just as David Flinch said. It's just that Miguel, he's taking time adjusting.
Oh, you can say that again.
Look, we don't have to stay with them, Gerald. Once we're vampires, we can go our own separate way. We could live here, in Almacena, in Haywood's Heath, anywhere, just so long as we discipline ourselves.
She came to him and touched a hand to his cheek.
No one has to die, Gerald. We can be vampires and still be civilized.
Gerald considered for a moment, then smiled.
I'm not sure if Haywood's Heath is quite ready for vampires, darling.
Well, then we better not go there. At least not permanently.
You really don't mind dumping them? I mean, dumping Lydia?
I don't want to be with anyone that makes you unhappy, Jerry.
Gerald took her in his arms.
All right. Well, let's sleep on it. If we can, that is.
Don't worry. I have sleeping pills with me. We'll sleep late, but I don't think his lordship's houses will mind too much. They'll still be there, empty as ever, whenever we manage to struggle out the door.
Miguel didn't know where he was going. He was driving in a northerly direction towards Camden, hoping to come across the River Thames, or an area of waste ground. But everywhere was nothing but endless, silent, urban landscape, road after road of houses, shops, and apartment buildings. This shouldn't have come as a surprise to him. After all, this was his second night in London. But until now, the city had been merely a background, sliding past the windows of cars in which he was a passenger. But now, he was really seeing it for the first time, and there was nowhere, absolutely nowhere, to dump a body.
Mierda!
He cried.
This is fucking bullshit!
He scratched furiously at his shoulder and squirmed in his seat. Why was he itching so badly? It was like the skin of his whole body was one big itch. No, not itching, tingling. He stepped on the brakes, halting the car in the middle of the road. This was stupid. He should turn around now while he still had an idea of how to get back. The corpse was out of the house. That was all that mattered. But what if the Bensons took the car out the next day? What if Lydia wanted it tomorrow night? No, he had to get rid of it. He rubbed his neck and felt the skin was puckered with goosebumps.
What the fuck? What is wrong with me?
Suddenly the car felt stifling, the seatbelt pinning him so tight he felt his skin couldn't breathe. He unbuckled the belt, threw open the door and got out. He threw his head back and gasped a lungful of cool air and froze. The night was draining from the sky, the rooftops in front of him standing stark against the simmering azure of the coming dawn. How long did he have before the sun crested those buildings? An hour? Two? Or less? He dropped his gaze and saw a hoarded-up launderette in front of him. He stared at it, his mind racing. He should go back. There was an alley by the launderette. If he turned back now, he'd have no problem. There was something in the alley. Lydia would understand. Accidents happened. He walked to his right, peering into the alley. It was pitch black down there. No human eyes would be able to see a thing. But quite clearly, he could see a builder's contenedor. He wasn't sure of the English word. It was full to the brim with rubble and shattered shop fittings, presumably from the launderette. If it was full, it would be taken away, probably at some time later today, and replaced with another. They'd take it to a dump or a landfill somewhere, the contents all tumbling over each other and burying themselves in a heap. His mind pictured a rolling landscape of trash, the sky full of seagulls cawing and screaming. They'd never find the body there, and if they did, they'd have no idea where she came from. It was perfect. With his new strength, he could lift or push aside anything in there, dump the body in, and pull the rubbish back over her. He grinned, thanking Satan in his mind for bringing him to this thing, this skip. Yes, that was the word. Why did they call it that? He wondered as he got into the car and reversed it back to the mouth of the alley. Contenedores don't skip, or jump, or even walk. He shook his head as he pulled on his rubber gloves. English. Such a stupid language. And so, Miguel dumps a body in a skip in Camden. That body will soon darken the morning of Inspector Clare Redmond, and the hunt for the London vampire will begin. But Lydia won't know any of that until the following evening. Right now, she's at home in bed, dreaming, no doubt, about her lovely evening with James Harrington and all the dark things it promises. For it was a lovely evening, and it does promise dark things. Dark, dark things. And next time, we'll go on that date with her in episode 43 of Underwood and Flinch Underground. The music you're listening to is Ahmad Armour by Farid Farjad, brought to you courtesy of Taraneh Records and our good friend Fawaz Al Maloud. You can buy the track from iTunes or Amazon and, of course, stream it from Spotify. You could even include it into a little playlist, couldn't you? And so there we are, my friends. That was episode 42 of Underwood and Flinch Underground, and I hope you enjoyed it. Now, some of you with elephantine memories will recall that some of the things in this episode are inconsistent with things that have happened before relating to the body in the skip. That's because Underwood and Flinch Underground is a work in progress, and I am, as all novelists do, making it up as I go along. But unlike other novelists, I'm not able to go back and do my edits to earlier chapters without my readers knowing it, because unlike other authors, I publish my novel as I go along. I write it as I go along, and I publish it as I go along. And sometimes I discover things at a later stage in the process that I didn't know at an earlier stage, and, just like any other novelist, I have to deal with them. Sometimes I can write my way out of the situation. You know, I can bend the story to accommodate these changes, but other times I can't. And when this happens, and it is very, very rare that it does, I have to go back and make some edits to an earlier episode. And that is the case here. Nothing big, nothing seismic, just a question of hair colour, position of the body when it's discovered, etc., etc. The story itself doesn't change in any way. The only thing that's affected is the general appearance of a dead body. So if you were planning on getting in touch with me about that, you with the super brilliant memories, you don't need to. I'm on it. I'm rewriting it at the moment. I will re-record it, and in a few days' time, it'll be like the earlier version was never there. This is the process of novel writing. It doesn't just drop out of the author's head and land on the bookseller's shelf. Oh no, it has to evolve. It has to be developed and endlessly, endlessly edited until it's done. And here's the interesting thing. Here at Patreon, by being my sponsor, you are privy to this process. You are coming along with me for the whole creative process, not just receiving the book that pops out at the other end and lands on the bookseller's shelf. It's like I said in the introduction, this is a scene, man. In the future, when Underwood and Finch is the international sensation that will one day be, others will say that they were into it years ago. But they won't know anything about this. They won't be privy to the process in the way that you are. Because unlike you, they weren't here. And so, on that happy note, I'd like to thank you once again for doing what you do to enable me to do what I do. I'm going to get some Underwood and Finch out to you sooner this month. Perhaps a full episode, perhaps a drabble or two. But I'm determined to shorten the wait between Underwood and Finch things. And so, I will. Huzzah!
Huzzah!
Yes, huzzah! And so, until the moon rises again over Underwood and Finch, thank you for listening, and farewell.